Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming. Tonight, I would like to talk about communication. And I'll talk more loudly to make sure that we can communicate. This is really, one of the most important aspects of creating a mindful environment for ourselves and for others. It's this topic of communication. And also an extremely challenging one. The Buddha talked about four principles of communication in describing right speech. One is truthfulness. Second is kindness. Third is usefulness. And fourth is peace. So now, if you're like me, it may not always be very clear to me or to others, you know, how to really adhere to these principles in our complex world. So maybe we can spend a little time thinking and talking about it and reflecting on it. For one, I think we can all relate to the fact that this is a very dynamic process. When we are feeling good and rested and not stressed and not tired, maybe have meditated for a while, we might feel very peaceful and might be able to feel very compassionate towards when presented with a challenge. But what about when we are not? What about when we're tired, when we haven't had enough sleep, when we're stressed? Maybe it might be more difficult. Now, one of the things in the course of Buddhist training, which often occurs in a monastery, there would often be stresses because of the difficult lifestyle, getting up in the morning at 3 a.m, not having enough sleep, many duties, and close, people are living in close quarters under a lot of stress. And this provides a training environment for people to be able to engage with their own challenges that would inevitably come up. In today's world, we often don't have that opportunity. Some of us are lucky and have that. But we also have available opportunities in the form of work settings or perhaps families that we belong to. And those are often quite challenging as well. And they provide us good opportunities for practice of these types of communication. And one of the things is to consider is even just the way that we look at these challenges is as opportunities to observe and as opportunities to reflect on what is important to us and how we communicate. Rather than maybe sometimes it might be very tempting to come from a reactive place, right? You know, to act from autopilot or act from an impulse to act. You know, it's very easy to be very peaceful. Sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's not, to be peaceful on the cushion. And then when something happens to us to actually go back to a autopilot in the way that we are acting. I was living with my mother-in-law until just a few years ago, for many years, and she was aware that I had taken some ordination vows here at the Zendo back some years ago. And then, you know, I was returning from some Saturday morning meditation, and she was really getting on my nerves, as sometimes mother-in-laws will do. And I said something very brash, and she looked at me, she's like, how come we're not done with this already? La la, I don't know, remember what it was that I snapped. And she looks at me, she's like, you know, you're not looking very much like a monk at the moment. And I was actually, oh man, and you know, I came back to myself and I realized, no, I'm not, you know, I'm not at the moment. I can do better. I think I can do better. So I think that recognizing that it's a very dynamic process, that there's an intention that we might be putting out there in the world and with ourselves, and then there's the day-to-day life, which has its own pace and its own process. Hmm? So as we look at some of these guidances in more detail, we can, and I'd love to hear your stories and thoughts on this afterwards in a few minutes. Let's talk about truthfulness. What is that? What do we mean by truthfulness? Yeah? And, you know, one obvious thing is it factual? Did this thing that we're talking about actually happen in some version, right? And that's sometimes easy to find out, sometimes not so easy. Maybe, you know, from the scientific sense, you know, that might be relatively simple to figure out. If you're talking about in a civil sense, I'm not always so sure. If we're talking about a political sense, also not so sure. But there's some idea that there's some objective shared reality, right? That's kind of may or may not be present. I think there's another sense in truthfulness as I was considering this, which is we think of truthfulness nowadays as, you know, often speaking my truth, right? Like, I feel this way. We talk about, you know, empathic communication, describing what is your truth? What are you feeling in this moment? I feel sad, or I feel neglected, or I feel whatever. So speaking our own truth is also important, right? What does it look like from your point of view? So often this comes in the form of feelings or observations. And it might reflect the reality that underlies it, of something that needs tending or attention. Then there's also the other person's truth. Right? We talk about the difference between intention, which is what I thought I said, and the impact, which is what the other person perceived or how it affected them. And so we can explore, you know, how are they perceiving something, a comment, or how are they perceiving an attitude, right? What is the process? How are they interpreting these events? We might want to help someone, but end up by hurting their feelings. There are many examples of this. And I think sometimes in Buddhist thought, that truthfulness is often contextualized as the idea of interdependent origination, which is this acknowledgement that there is no separate self, that we don't exist separate from other beings. We don't exist separate from really anything that exists. Every molecule, everything is all interconnected. And so sometimes that we're so intertwined that you can't even pull anything apart. Secondly, let's talk a little bit about kindness. Yeah. One way is through this, you know, we talk about empathy, and this idea that we are all intertwined helps us to also feel more empathy or compassion for others. It might lead us to be able to take a more thoughtful, maybe gingerly approach to difficult topics, understanding that something might require a different approach. Sometimes we have to approach things very energetically out of kindness or compassion. So it doesn't necessarily mean being soft, but maybe the capacity to be both soft and firm. Third, this idea of usefulness. Tara Brach talks about an acronym of she calls WAIT, which is why am I talking? This is great. You know, I've been thinking about that for the past few days. Why am I talking? What is my intent here? Why am I talking? And do we know our intent as clearly as we can when we're talking? Are we able to articulate it and then follow it through with our actions? Thich Nhat Hanh describes this portion of right speech as being consistent, having follow through for your plan, your action, and consistent over time as well, you know? And, you know, this has to do also with what is our general motivation? Is our motivation to achieve something, or is our motivation to, you know, to help all sentient beings? To make it the best possible for everybody. Just looking at what it is sometimes. The fourth section, you know, category is peace. And are our actions creating peace in the world? You know, sometimes we need to speak up against an injustice. To set things right. So it doesn't always mean to be quiet or to be meek. But it does mean to keep peace as our goal, as our objective, both internally and externally. Thich Nhat Hanh describes using peaceful language, so not nonviolent, non-judgmental, non-condemning, not spreading gossip. Jack Kornfield talks about good gossip. He says, you know, sometimes you need to transmit information in a very simple way, you know, and there can be such thing as good gossip in every community. So I don't know how, I guess I could agree to some of that. I think one needs to be very careful about what is good gossip and what is gossip. You know, my daughter went to Europe to visit Europe, and then we told her we've had some experience traveling through Europe, and we said, you know, don't leave your cell phone in the small pocket of your backpack. She like looked at us with like disdain in her eyes, and she's like, oh, come on, people. And of course, she was traveling through Italy and, you know, left her phone there. So afterwards, we're like, what happened? Look, I put it in the backpack, in the small pocket. So sometimes, you know, it's important to giving advice, even though it may seem difficult, it may actually carry some useful purpose. So maybe this is an example of good gossip. But all the while, you know, we're keeping an inner guideline for creating peace rather than sowing discord, you know, and often when we're, it begins with ourselves. If we're able to cultivate peace within ourselves through meditation and reflection, then we can more and more express that in our actions in the outer world as circumstances arise. But having that inner compass is important. You know, Les talks about who is driving the bus. Are you driving the bus, or who's driving this bus? And I think, lastly, I would add that this matter of communication with ourselves, kind of, often, you know, we notice things in ourselves and we can be very harsh with our own faults and mistakes. And you've made a mistake and then you're mad at yourself. And, you know, Tara Brach calls this shooting the second arrow, that you've something has happened that's hurt you, and then you get mad at yourself and judgmental, and you're actually causing more grief for yourself. And it actually keeps you from being able to be more effective and peaceful in the world, because you're creating more suffering. And so she says, no, stop. Don't shoot that second arrow. You know, recognize the mistake and go from there, you know. And it's a very natural process, I think. Maybe some of us learned it when we were children. Maybe some of us didn't have exposure and sort of made it up as we went along, trying to educate ourselves. You know, sometimes when we're trying to take control of our lives, we might become our own worst enemy. You know, people who, I don't know if any of you here might be running your own companies. People often say, you know, working for yourself is like your boss is really nasty. It's really hard. So, you know, I think sometimes when we find some difficult communication happening, a few principles that can be helpful is, one, understanding what happens, what's happening, without trying to change anything, just understanding. And then asking with curiosity, is there more? Is there, what else is there? What else is there that we're not seeing, that I might not be seeing, that might be not be evident? Third is really validating everything that we see and letting it be there, letting it be what it is. And then the fourth step is moving forward, looking for the new way forward, looking for what needs to happen now that we've understood all these sorts of things. So those are my thoughts about communication, and I look forward to hearing from you all, your thoughts and considerations. Thank you.
Thank you for your talk, Brenda. And during your talk, a couple thoughts came up. One, I think, is something I've learned the hard way, and that is the importance of always being very careful when telling people something that you believe is true, explaining exactly why you believe it's true. In other words, you know, if I believe something is true about reality, how do I know it? If I believe, say, even if I believe something that everyone here probably believes, say, in this, what we call conventional reality, and what we call history, I'm very, very, I have very strong faith that there was some guy who was called the Buddha, and he lived in, you know, in the past. But if I just say, oh yeah, the Buddha was this dude, he existed in so-and-so, am I really telling the truth in a sense that is epistemically rigorous, if that makes sense? How do I know what I know? And am I telling how I know or how I believe this? Or am I just spreading a rumor? Am I muddying the waters? You mentioned a lot that people tend to believe in something called objective reality, and that is not something that's going to survive Zen practice. That is not a belief that is tenable. And even subjective reality is also not objectively subjective, because objective reality is not a coherent concept. So we just have this this sense of reality around us, this sense of interdependent shared reality, maybe intersubjectivity, and we're all stuck in this same illusion that we call conventional reality. And that I think is a very strong sense of a source of compassion. You know, when I feel what I consider to be physical pain or suffering or something, it's real to me. This is real to everybody that feels it. It doesn't matter if it's ultimately real, because what we consider ourselves, our skandhas, our component parts, none of those are ultimately real in any ultimate sense. They can't be. Even interdependent origination only goes so far. And I've probably given people more than they want to think about right now. So I'm going to hand back the mic and let you have your thoughts on that.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So much there. Where to start? I think, you know, to your point, it's our experience is often what we call our truth, right? And that is, there's an objective and a subjective component to that, to both our perceptions and our experiences. Is any of this real? You know, what does reality mean, right? And I think, right? Exactly. And yet we have to function in today's world. And yet we have to meditate and you know, all of those things. You have to say something. And so really, I think holding both of those is how I look at it, is that you have to hold both of those, that we're making an approximation and we know it's going to be false, but we're going to reach out and try to touch each other's reality, something like that. Yeah, thank you.
So I was 10 years old. I think I was in the, no, 5 years old. I was in the fifth grade, ran a 100-meter dash, brought home a silver medal. And took it to my mother, showed it to her. She said, not good enough, you should have gotten the gold. So sometimes, you know, when you look at things, I'm saying this not to create a sense of sympathy or empathy, but when somebody says things like that to you, you can say to yourself from an objective reality point of view that this is happening to me. Why is this happening to me? Okay? From the subjective point of view, I can look at the world and say, I did this, and then there's the rest of the world. But when we stop labeling, judging, and comparing, and when we sit, we can see things in a very different light. And for me, you know, looking back, I can see this was done to my mother, that she was told not good enough. So, you know, and that's what really this having an understanding that the other person that is coming from that place has also been put down and insulted and all this stuff, has gone through all the roller coasters of life, right? Is important to see, but that does not take away from us the feeling that is underneath the general, you know, connected feeling that we have for the other person. And we can, I can still talk to my mother, I can still, you know, communicate with her. And the whole idea is the feeling is still there, that this is another human being who's made a lot of mistakes, who's done a lot of good things and bad things. But there's no sense of regret that she said that. I just brought that up to make a point here, that, you know, seeing the other person being able to, when we sit, these four things that you talked about, you know, as far as communication, these are just guideposts. For seeing the other person as they are, who they are, where they are in this moment. Because that, what I just told you, is a story, okay? And that's gone. If you told me that my past existed, right, and to go grab it and bring it back, I can't bring it back. It's gone. I don't know what's out there, what's in front of me 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years ahead of me. So in this moment, I'm sitting here with you, sharing the story with you. I'm connected with all of you, connected with the rest of the people in this world, right? This is the reality that we're in. This is the shared reality, you know? And this is how we communicate with each other, you know, being in this moment. I was listening to Gabor Mate, the psychotherapist, and he was talking about this book that this woman had from nurse from Australia had written, The Five Regrets of Dying People. And one of the things that he talked about, two regrets, he said one of the big regrets that people who are dying, who are in palliative care, is that they weren't authentic. And the other thing that happens, and this comes down to communication, is that when we feel something, when somebody comes and says to us, how are you feeling? Are you feeling sad? We say, no, I'm not feeling sad. I'm happy. We put on a face, you know? And that was the second regret. Out of the five big regrets, he said, these are the two big ones that always get us. But being authentic and being able to communicate with that another person in that moment and seeing them for who they are beyond what is going on is real communication. And this is what these four guideposts are for, you know. So beneficial, useful, and truthful. And what's the fourth one?
If they're ready to hear it,
yeah. But, you know, all we can do is communicate, you know.
Right. And recognizing they may not be ready to hear it.
That's fine, too. That's why I'm saying that it just comes down to, but the problem is that what happens to us is that we are taught to fuse with our thoughts. Mm-hmm. We're told to feel our thinking all the time. We're feeling our thinking all the time. You know, if I think this, it makes me feel good. If I think that, it makes me feel bad. And when you just let go of all of that, what you've been taught, even this whole idea of feeling your thinking. If somebody tells me, go read Plato, it'll make you really feel good. Will it? You know? Go read the Book of Satan written by Aleister Crowley. That will really make you feel horrible, will it? You know? So what it is, I think the Buddha was saying with this truthfulness and this communication strategies is it's really about your attitude. What kind of attitude are you going to take? Are you going to take an attitude that comes to you with the point of view of readiness, that you are going to accept what is in front of you, or you're going to go back somewhere and pull up a story, or you're going to jump ahead and start making something up? We live here, we live in this, wherever we are, it's like we do this practice, we come and clean the zendo. Sometimes I'm cleaning the floors, I'm looking at the grooves on the floor going, I never noticed that one before, so I'm sweating and, sweat is pouring down and looking at the grooves, I saw that one, okay, today, this is good, so that is my reality in that moment, But, so we can get stuck on stories, we can do, get stuck on ideas and all this stuff, or we can come back and be with somebody who can be difficult and be with them. Because we have to learn to be authentic with ourselves, and we have to learn to, and in that, and by being authentic in that way, we can really feel that moment. What is going on in that moment, not fused with our thoughts, not feel our thoughts, letting go of all that stuff. Coming to your own breath, coming to your own experience. This is what coming to your own breath is all about. You come back to your own breath. Once you come back to this, this is all there is to it in the end. Without breath, there is nothing else there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Great example of being your own truth, being, and operating from there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just great. Like this incense of burning.
Yes. Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you, Umar. Dave?
Thank you for your talk, Brenda. I guess I just wanted to say a couple of things. One is in response to this discussion about objective and subjective reality. And of course, in sort of everyday conversation, we tend to idealize objective reality, and subjective reality is just this sort of mushy opinion stuff. But as people have noted, the more we get into our meditation practice, the more we realize that the world that we live in really is a creation of our subjective reality. And I mean, if you really sort of just try to come up with a simple description of what those two things are, subjective reality is based on your own experience of the world, and objective reality is based on this artificial notion that you are separate, the observer is separate from the thing being observed, and objective reality is independent of the observer, very different from subjective reality. But really trying to choose one of those as being superior, or just sort of hop back and forth between them as the situation merits, doesn't strike me as being the ultimate goal. It seems to me that those two different views of the world are sort of like looking out of one eye or the other. Your eyes see things slightly differently, and you don't once and for all, or even from time to time, want to choose which eye you're going to look through, because it's the fusion of the two that gives you perspective, gives you stereo vision, gives you depth. And so it seems to me that, I mean, if you think of objective reality as being the separation or difference between the observer and the thing observed, and subjective reality as being the unity or harmony between the observer and the thing observed. What you're really talking about there in Zen terms is the harmony of difference and equality.
Wow. Beautiful. Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to just mention and see what you might think about it is when we talk about the role of communication in our practice, one of the things, of course, that is the most fundamental barrier to communication is if you and the person you're trying to communicate with do not speak the same language. It may work out fine for a silent retreat for a while, but in general, it's can be a real problem. And one of the examples of this that always been a real head scratcher for me is what happened very early when Suzuki Roshi first came to the United States. And he had a number of students who gathered around him, including some who were just very, very intensely, you know, into the practice and everything. And early on, he sent one or two of these people back. I think it was to a Heiji, but he sent them back to study in Zen temples in Japan. And they had a terrible experience because basically the people in the temples would yell at them in Japanese and they didn't understand. And then the next time they saw them, they'd yell at them again for not responding to the first time they yelled at them. And it's tempting to say that, well, this was just sort of, you know, naive foolishness on Suzuki Roshi's part. But every time I've ever felt like anything that Suzuki Roshi did was naive or foolish, it's turned out that it was just my own lack of understanding of what he was getting at. You know, I mean, it wasn't his pidgin English when he said things as it is, right? It wasn't just fractured English. He was really saying something very important. And I'm curious as to whether you have any sort of idea of what in the world Suzuki Roshi must have been thinking when he sent his English-speaking, non-Japanese-speaking students to Japan, and they got basically had the feathers beaten out of them in these Zen temples that they were supposed to study at. I mean, they literally, a couple of them came back sort of suffering from severe malnutrition because they couldn't even eat the food. Any thoughts on that?
I've spent a little time in Japan over the years, and so I'm thinking back to that of you know, I worked in an acupuncture clinic at the time, and I was trying to you know, enter this clinic, and I wrote, like, I really tried really hard, and I wrote this essay, and there were no women in this clinic, and so I wrote an essay for this teacher who was an elderly gentleman, blind practitioner, who would walk right through, and he said, I wrote the essay, and then he said, Brenda-san, very nice essay, too bad you're a woman. And I was like, okay, so I don't know what to do. So I was very, very upset and put a lot of energy into this. And then he walked through and out the door with his assistants. And then I was just kind of disoriented. And then one of the older fellow students walked up to me. He says, Brenda-san, this is Japan. I said, yes. And he said, this is Japan. Okay, help me out here. And right now I'm not feeling too good. And he says, no does not mean no. I said, oh, really? What happens? How does that work? And he said, no. All of us, when we ask to join the clinic, he says no. And then you ask again. He'll probably say no again. And maybe three or four times, some of us five. You know, then he say yes. So I think even in the absence of language, there are, you know, the teaching is passed on in even you know, even in the yelling. If you ask them, you know, 20 years later, what did you learn in Japan, they might have some answer that was more than the yelling. But yes.
Okay, good point.
Yeah.
I guess it's partly, you know, a cultural thing too, right? The old thing about how Buddhism takes on the shape of the culture, like water goes into a bottle, you know?
Right. I think it's hard for him to transmit because he had it, but he may not even have known quite how to transmit it. It's like, just go to Japan and see if maybe you can get a piece of it there, you know? So yeah, we're still learning about what is the American container of Buddhism? You know, it'll be different, but I'm not sure yet quite how.
Well, I'm sure you know the story about the Japanese teacher back in sometime in the 20th century came to the U.S. and was hearing all this complaining from a U.S. teacher about how difficult it was being. And he sort of smiled and said, yes, the first 100 years is always the hardest.
Yes. I love that. Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you. Okay, I think we're on that note. We'll call it a day. Thank you, everybody.
This talk was brought to you by the Kanando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to kanando.org. That's kanno.org.